episode 477 of Global from Asia, Mindset, Journey, Achievement of Your E-Commerce and Entrepreneur Dream. Let's dive in.
Welcome to the Global from Asia podcast, where the daunting process of running an international business is broken down into straight up actionable advice.
Thank you all for choosing to listen to or watch episode 477 of Global from Asia. Cross-Border Summit 2025 has been getting great feedback, and we are preparing for an epic 2026 edition.
Yes, we are staying consistent, preparing for the 8th Cross-Border Summit. Close to 500 podcast episodes here at Global from Asia, and it relates to this week's episode, Mindset, the Journey to Create and Build.
True. It is about being consistent.
So this podcast, John Ho from Alt Living in Chiang Mai, and I had an in-person event before Cross-Border Summit talking about moving your business to new heights.
Great. And you also want to share some inspiring talks with your son after the show, right?
Exactly. In our outro session after this main content, we will share that story and other takeaways. Now let's tune in.
Exciting. Yes. Let's now tune in.
Before we jump into the main discussion, a quick word from our sponsor. If you're an advanced e-commerce entrepreneur looking to network and level up, mark your calendars for Cross-Border Summit 2026. Building on the success of 2025, this event will bring together global leaders in cross-border trade, AI tools, and tariff navigation. Early bird tickets coming soon. Visit crossbordersummit.com for details. Now, back to the show.
So, good evening, everyone. I'm super happy to host, to co-host this event because I have my friend here, Mike.
What's up?
And
hello, hello. Hey, man.
He has so much knowledge and experience in this topic that I really hope whoever decides to join here will get a lot of value out from this. Plus the very yummy food that we have for you after the conversation. After.
You guys are stuck here.
But let me make a proper introduction of Mike. I've known Mike since, I want to say, 3-4 years ago at least.
Yeah, it's been a few years.
Yeah. And for me, Mike is one of the very committed person in Chiang Mai that's not from here, like me, who wants to build a community, contribute to the city by creating really cool events and bring people from all over the world and really add value to all these things that we're doing together. I'll let him do a little bit of an introduction first, but I think first of all, I would like you to give Mike an applause.
Okay. Thank you.
For just being here and hosting this event and providing the food.
My pleasure, thanks. Yeah, I'm Mike Michelini, originally from the US. I've been selling online for 21 years, since 2004. China 12 years, Thailand about 5 total so far. A little bit before COVID, a little bit after COVID. And I make full-time living on selling online, on Amazon mostly, a few different brands. And as John said, I love community building, mostly in e-com, but also some in Web3 as well. And I've been doing community events for, I don't know. Yeah, not as long as e-commerce, but since 2007.
2007. But you started in 2004, and let's take a memory lane here, because like you are from America, but how did you even came to Asia to begin with? And this having an e-commerce shop 20 years ago, can you give us a little bit of like how did it happen back then when nobody knew about e-commerce?
We thought it was too late to start on e-commerce 20 years ago. There was events like this, and people thought it was too late to do e-commerce 21 years ago. In 2004, people thought it was too late. There was a much bigger group than this, and everybody's, oh, it's too late. The guy on stage is saying, it's not too late to start selling. But everybody thought they were too late in 2004. I wish I didn't do the vlog. I didn't record stuff. I don't even think I have pictures. But the quick story is I always wanted to do my own business. For some reason, since I was at church with my parents, and great, maybe I was 10, and I saw a magazine about Silicon Valley or online, and nobody knew how to do their own business, and I just wanted to figure it out, but I thought I had to get an MBA. I thought you had to get an MBA to start your own business. And I remember my kid's the same age now. My son's 11. And I drew a timeline of my life, like it was some class project about what you want to do in your life. And I had get good grades, go to a good college, get a good job, get an MBA, start my own business. That's what I thought the track was. And I was on that track. I worked on Wall Street, and I started selling on eBay while I was on Wall Street. So I took the job that paid me the most money possible. I hated my job. I don't think anybody there liked their job, but I was just saving as much money as I could. And I was doing my Kaplan GMAT prep test to go to MBA. And as I was selling on eBay, I went to these prep classes starting about this time after work. And they're like, what's the geometry of a circle? Or like the triangle, like remembering. And I was like, this is some bullshit, man. And then my favorite story is, maybe it was the first class of this prep Kaplan GMAT prep test in Wall Street, on Water Street. And they're like, what do you do? Where do you want to work? Your name, where you work, and what do you want to do with your MBA? Hi, I'm Joanne. I work at Lehman Brothers. I want to get MBA to get a raise. I'm Joe. I work at Goldman Sachs. I want to get a management position. They're all just trying to move up the ladder. It came to me, and it was like a classroom. I'm Mike. I work at Deutsche Bank, and I want to get an MBA to start my own business. And the eyeballs, like in the Matrix movie when they're all looking at you, they're like, the eyes just were like knives. Everybody's like, you don't belong here. You're in the wrong room. So I dropped out of the prep test, and I had saved up a lot of money, at least for me. And I said, I'm going to use this on my own business. And I quit. I quit my job. And I gave months notice. They thought I was all crazy. I was on the trading floor. So they said, tell us when you IPO so I can short your stock.
Oh, my God.
And they're like, you're going to come back begging for your job in less than a year.
That's like investment bank 20 years ago was like the best job you can have. And they pay crazy amount of bonus because this is pre-Lehman. And everyone who had, like you said, you were working in Deutsche and then Goldman, all those people, they're not necessarily wrong. So if you look back in time and you said, if you ask yourself, did you make the right decision? Like, how do you have these conversations?
Usually it's around Christmas, like around this time of year, everybody's reflecting on the new year. And there's Christmas parties. And you get drunk like every night in Wall Street. At least then you would get drunk like every day. You go to like different Christmas party every night and get drunk. So we were talking about what we want to do. And everybody has an excuse. And I had excuses like, oh, I hate my job, but I can't quit. Like my bonus is coming or my vesting is coming or my lease is renewing and I can't lose my lease. Even I had excuses. And I left some money on the table for sure. Like I was 4.5 years in. 6 more months I would have invested in my Deutsche Bank stock. But that was the one negative, but then my lease was up in New York. They put those scary letters under your door. Your lease is up. If you don't re-sign, they're gonna evict you. It was like scary. And my roommates, are we staying? Are we going? Are we staying? We're going. And my bonus came, year end. So it was the end of 06, and I quit in 07, like around February 07. And the only negative was I left 6 months before my vest. But if I had vested, then I would have been on my contract. I wouldn't have quit my job. I would have still been in there. So everybody has people buy real estate, then you're stuck in your real estate, and, you know. So I don't regret it at all. I would go back in the day, I would go every year back to New York and I'd visit them. And they're still at the same desk. The frame of their family didn't even move in the year that I was gone. Like the dust, I think if I had dusted it, like it would have been ready for me to dust the next year. Like they were still on the same desk.
Wow.
And they're making money, I was making over $100,000 a year. And I got, you know, bonuses and everything was good. But I was really depressed, to be honest. And most people were really depressed.
And you started with eBay. Can you remember the first product you sold?
I tried to do poker supplies. Drop shipping
poker supplies.
Poker sets and romantic gifts and bar supplies, which I still sell to this day.
Wow.
My main product is bar products, and it was that. So what I sold was stuff, guy stuff, like men's gift. right? Like stuff I like bachelor products. So like poker stuff, drinking stuff, romantic gift stuff. I had some funny names and I have various eBay accounts. But I still tell people, just start to sell. Maybe don't put $20,000 into inventory, but just start to sell something. A lot of people say drop ship. Drop ship's not a business. Amazon's not a business. It's a channel of your distribution. So yeah, I sold poker stuff and romantic gifts and bar supplies.
Yeah, and we're definitely going to go in deeper into the technical stuff so people can actually learn how to start if they are thinking about this. I can relate a lot because I spent about 10 years in corporate. I spent 1 year in investment bank, which I hated. I think I was just trying to prove to my dad that I can also go into a bank if I want to. But anyway, the transition period for myself, at least, working in a corporate job for 10 plus years, and then trying to be an entrepreneur and sell products. And for me, the biggest challenge then was the mindset, because I was already brainwashed by the corporate world of you're going in, you're clocking in, you're doing your stuff, you get paid regardless. If you're better, you get a raise or you get a better promotion, but it's like the same routine. And once you're in the system and when you come out from the system, for me, it was a lot of struggle at the very beginning of my journey. Do you have something similar, or what was your journey like for that transitional period?
If you Google my name, you'll see like Wall Street to China. When I was in China, they love to say like I left Wall Street and went to China. There was a 6 month gap. I went to California. I was almost gonna do the Silicon Valley, but I chose China over Silicon Valley. But for sure that was scary when I stopped getting a direct deposit of my salary. Cause there's like a delay. You get, I think it was like a month after I finally got my last paycheck. Every 2 weeks you get that direct deposit. It was huge. I'm saying it's like $8,000, I don't know. It was like a lot. Every 2 weeks into my Bank of America. So we get like addicted. This money just gets deposited into your bank account. And right, it's like, I just gotta wake up, go to work.
Try not to fail.
Try not to mess up. Sometimes I had a chug of hot sauce. I chugged a bottle of hot sauce once, straight. That still hurts my stomach thinking about it, but I didn't do the chicken nugget eating contest or the head shaving on the trading floor.
But we don't have that in Asia, but yeah.
Okay, but for sure it was hard. And actually lonely, to be honest. I went to California. The story is my friend left. I'm originally from Connecticut, so he moved out there to change his life, and he had extra room. And I went to visit him during Christmas or around winter 06. And he's, oh, just come out here. I got an extra room, $400 a month to month. Just give me a month notice. So that was part of my plus minus quitting my job. I was like, I can go to California, Ocean Beach, 4 blocks from the beach, $400 a month, right? No contract. And so I cut my costs really low. And I went to California. And then I went to Canton Fair in China in October 07. And I thought it would only be for a month. And then I extended it for an extra week, 5 weeks total. And then I was like, I went back for Christmas to my parents in 07, and I was like, Mom, Dad, I don't think I'm coming back, man. It's an evolution, but yeah. It was definitely scary, especially the first couple months, but I did build up income. It's not like I was just burning money, but I saved up money and I was having income from my eBay e-commerce business.
I still remember the days, I don't know if anyone has used eBay before. Okay, there's still half, okay, one third of the room. Now eBay is a very different type of platform, obviously. But back then, people were also selling, but they were also trying to find different types of products. And my guess is you going to Canton Fair is also trying to source products so that you can find unique products you can sell on the platform. And the question I have is more relevant is, does that still work today? Because you did it 20 years ago. And people still go to Canton Fair, but what is the difference? Or if someone were to start today, what do they need to do?
Yeah, of course, it's totally different. I'm mostly Amazon now. I didn't really totally dig into the story, so I'm not sure if it's 100%, but I believe Amazon lost a lawsuit to eBay. Because Amazon staff were contacting eBay sellers to list on Amazon. And I even remember doing phone calls back when Amazon gave it about me as a seller. They used to call me. And I think they were just trying to get sellers off eBay onto Amazon. But of course, I don't sell on Amazon, eBay anymore. If you talk to a lot of OG sellers, they usually start on eBay. eBay was the main thing from 03 to 10, 11. maybe a little bit longer. In China too. I remember when I went to China, I met a lot of sellers. And they were eBay sellers too. And there was all these different communities of sellers. But now, of course, the game has changed. Actually, I talked to somebody last week. We had a dinner and they're like, would I sell on Amazon now if I was starting from zero? Probably not. I would probably start, even though I have no clue about TikTok or something, I probably would start on D2C right now, like Shopify and get some kind of traffic through.
D2C meaning?
Direct to consumer. So there's two groups of e-commerce now. There's the Amazon or marketplace, and then there's D2C. D2C usually means Shopify, but it doesn't have to be Shopify. It could be TikTok, or it could be e-commerce, it could be Wix. It's just a way to get traffic and people buying from your own website. Marketplace means like Amazon, maybe eBay, Shopify, or Shopee, Lazada, Taobao, Tmall. Those are marketplaces.
Right.
D2C is like getting to your own website.
So you started with eBay, and then you transitioned to Amazon. You told people if you were to start from zero now, you wouldn't do Amazon. And so you would probably D2C. Yeah. And why is that? Like, why is that the trend? Or why do you think that has a better advantage?
A little plug. I have a conference coming up in a week. And sorry, I don't want to have a screensaver on while I talk. You need a lot of money to do on Amazon now. We're having one of our sessions is product research, and people spend $3,000 to $10,000 on research before they launch a product. I don't know if I want to tell people here to do $3,000 to $10,000 on product research. They do polls. They use these survey platforms, and they spend $3,000 to $10,000, which I think is hard for me to tell somebody here to spend that. But even I am scared to launch new products on Amazon. As
every single product, people usually spend $3,000 to $10,000.
We're recommending it now.
Oh, okay.
That's like what the experienced sellers are saying: spend $3,000 to $10,000 before you launch, because once you launch, it's really hard to stop, because you got to buy from China or anywhere. Thailand, I do a lot in Thailand.
Hmm.
So you want to reduce the risk of inventory and like all that work by product research. So surveys, IntelliVee is one, Foo is another, even MTurk. Any way you can get product research so your customer will buy it once you actually list it on Amazon. Because it takes so long to make the product, ship the product, get the product into Amazon, get the reviews. So you want to reduce the risk of that as much as possible. I feel if I start from zero today, I would do a D2C website. I would do Facebook ads or some kind of advertising to then validate this product. And then maybe I would go to Amazon later.
And what do you think is that in terms of saving costs or the chances of success? Because the other thing about D2C is you don't have the marketplace, you don't have the platform, so people can't find you. And then the money will be spent on ads. Or how good you are with SEO, I suppose. So there's pros and cons?
So I've talked to Amazon's staff. They'll say, yeah, it does cost a lot, but it's still the cheaper or the same as doing Facebook ads or Google ads, because you're going to spend a lot on those ads anyways. And I still make most of my money on Amazon, personally. But I just feel lately, the last few years, it's gotten just really competitive and expensive. And you have to go big.
Okay. I want to go to the topic, because this is more like a prelude, but more understanding why you picked the topic, from freelance to e-commerce brand owner. How do you define a freelance? Even though, like, for me or for some people, they said, oh, I'm a freelancer, but I'm also a business owner. So what is that difference?
I define a freelancer as somebody who sells their time. So maybe they have an hourly rate or somewhat they're charging based on their time. And they maybe bill by the hour, maybe they bill by the month, but they're trading their time for money. And e-commerce, of course, you think about physical product, but I was also hoping to just give you some ideas about productized service. So productized service, I think, is the next level where you can take a service you do, and instead of you delivering it, you sell it, maybe somebody else in your team does it. So I think that's like agency or productized service. But freelancer I define as selling your time for money pretty much directly.
Okay. And I want to gauge interest here. Who here is thinking about selling a physical product? Raise your hands. Just want to check. Okay. And who here is thinking about selling a productized service? Okay. Oh, and I see someone also raised their hands.
I see like
twice.
22, yeah.
Okay. Is there any breakdown or is there any guidance in terms of, okay, what is the difference or how do you approach the different types of products to sell on a platform or an
DTC? You know, I don't want to say do both, but you could do both or you could eventually do both. The way I try to tell people, like I do the bar supplies, and it's funny, I don't really drink as alcohol like I used to in New York days, but I still feel like I'm not doing what I say because it's a lot of work, but I could do a productized service of that same niche that I sell physical products of. So I try to tell people to do something you have some kind of a passion about in a niche, not just a product. So if you are very passionate about something, maybe even your freelancing of what you're doing, or product as service, you can sell a physical product. So you try to, it's like vertical integration. So you could sell services or products. You're solving problems, right? I think an entrepreneur's job is to solve a problem. We get caught up in the solution. Like that's the solution, selling a physical product, doing a productized service. I think you should step back, think about what is my why, right? There's Simon Sinek. I feel like I say his name wrong. And he start with why, right? So we can talk about the solution, what we're doing to solve the problem, but maybe you should step back and think, what is maybe my passion, my purpose? Like I was downstairs, there's this recycle, I didn't have time to dig into it, but there's like a recycle section down there.
Yep, we have some bins.
And maybe that's a service, maybe that's a product, maybe that's both. Like even a factory, I've learned, I used to think factories, they're not product businesses, they're service businesses. In my opinion, a factory is a service business. Because factories don't take inventory. They don't have inventory usually. They sell a service, they get paid. They have humans, usually are robots now, delivering the service and then they ship the product. So you could be a factory. So what I'm saying is I hope you enjoy what you sell or what you do. Because I think, especially with AI now, you have to have a passion about it. You have to want to solve some problem or help some kind of people.
When you say a freelancer is selling their time versus a business, an e-commerce or an e-commerce owner, a business owner is productizing their service or a physical product and branding it, what's the difference? Because I'm still not 100% clear how to tell people you're a freelancer or you're a brand. Or is it, you just need a brand?
I mean, I think the difference is hopefully you can get yourself out of selling yourself. Because yourself is not scalable. So I think a freelancer means if you're out sick, you're not getting paid. But if you're a product service brand owner, if you're out sick, you're still getting paid. Or the business, as long as the service or you're delivering your service or your product, you're getting paid. So I think, it's not for everybody. You can still be a freelancer your whole life, and there's many people that are happy as a freelancer, but it's one step up from an employee.
Meaning your revenue source is independent of your time or activity.
Yeah, I believe the goal, most of my friends that are business owners, we try to not be connected to the service or we're delivering directly. Maybe at the beginning we are, but I think our goal is to have other people and other systems to do it so that I don't need to be the one to have to deliver it to get the money for it.
I look at myself as a case study, right? Because like I tell people I have a brand, I tell people I have a business, which is a service, right? But if I look at my daily routine or how many hours I put into my work, I still feel very involved in it. It's enjoyable. I'm not complaining about it. But then if I look at the definition and I say, to what point can I extract myself from the operation so that everything is still running independent to my time, I don't know how to answer that question myself.
I was here early. You were, there's G. G is here.
Yes.
He seems to be doing good. And then your front desk. And what I've been going crazy the last couple months is vibe coding or AI coding, right? My dad wanted me to be a programmer. And I just couldn't deal with it when I was younger because I didn't have patience for all the bugs. But now I'm trying to be a developer because that's the ultimate scale. So I think maybe you should look at the, because there's SOPs. A lot of us say standard operating procedure. So you try to teach managers or staff how to do things by standard operating procedure. But now with software, you can make like a software and then they operate the software. So maybe make software that standardizes the process so that people follow the software, both the customer and the staff or the employee. And that takes you as the owner out. Because I think software is the most ultimate way of doing that.
This comes to another aspect that I also think about, which is the skill sets you need to create a product, to sell a product, or to actually create the systems to sell the products. So what is your experience in that when you started? Because I'm sure you have that journey of being a freelancer that you try to learn those skills, and then now you're like, okay, this is too much of my time, I can't commit this, and then I need to switch. But that's not just like a switch.
There's so many people still, especially in Amazon sellers, they're like seven-figure. That means like multi-million-dollar sellers yearly. Maybe not profit, but at least revenue. And they do everything themselves still. There's people coming to our conference next week that still do everything themselves. And yeah, you can do that. Now AI is even saying that there's going to be, the future's going to be like unicorns that are like no staff or just one human and all AI. Maybe that... So that might be the new way, right? But I still think you need other humans in your organization. Maybe you don't need as many now, but I still think you need humans in your organization. So I think the goal is hiring. Of course, I have a lot of people in the Philippines that work with me. So I have a lot of Philippine VAs, they call them. I don't like to call them VA, virtual assistant. But usually the first step is maybe get like one VA, right? Person. Start with one person. Don't hire like 10 people, right? Hire one person. Maybe they're your assistant. Usually call it like a general VA, GVA.
Yep.
So they maybe are a wide range of stuff they do for you. Maybe your email or your social media or some various basic tasks just to get the experience of giving them. So I do a podcast. This will be a podcast. And that was actually a really good experience for me to learn about standard operating procedure. So the podcast started in 2013, and it started, I didn't want to edit the audio. I didn't want to edit it. So it was like one of the, not the very first, but one of the second or third people I hired was an audio editor to edit my podcast. But then you broke down the process of making a podcast, and you, not one person can, you, back then especially, cannot do the whole thing. So you break it down, and you make, you use Google Doc for easy, right? First, and you write down all the tasks. Okay. So basically, it was called like non-programmer business processes to make SOPs. So we saw all talk about SOPs. But now with software, now I can even make like software that's like an SOP. So I'm almost not really making SOPs anymore. I give my staff a software I make for them to operate.
Right.
Anyway.
So freelancer, I think I have more clarity now because it's more like a solopreneur business. You're working by yourself, you don't hire people. Now you need to figure out how to outsource or delegate some of the task. So then you want to look at your budget and say, okay, I want to hire people to help me out with some of it, if not all. And how do you approach that as in, okay, because there's, again, there's 10, like I imagine my operation again, right? There's always someone I want to hire. I want to hire an HR. I want to hire like more house cleaning. I want to hire an operations manager. But then there's only a finite type of resources. So let's say if I am a solopreneur to begin with, it's an online platform, so I imagine the labor is less intensive. How should I go about, okay, who is my first person I need to hire?
Of course, this is, I feel like it's changing right now with AI, so I feel like I don't want to go through old stuff. I'm changing my whole organization this year. I've made like a 3-month announcement to my whole team. It's even related to this. I'm actually putting them in this program. I'm trying to help them change. I don't want to let go of my team. My team, a lot of them have been with me like 4, 5, 6, 7, some even 10 years. But I think, I don't really feel like talking about the old way and I'm inventing a new way. But I'm trying to even take my kind of staff now and make them an entrepreneur. It's hard. And
why do you want to do that?
It's even why I'm here today. I feel like that's the future. I feel like people need to operate a service. I think everybody has to operate a service now, or a product. I think the new way, I don't see the future of jobs and freelancing the way it is now. I give all these funny keywords, I don't feel like boring you. I have all these keywords, I call it centaur, the human horse, half human, half horse. And I've told my team, I call it the centaur model. So I'm telling them, you have to use AI now. I still want to keep you humans. And I try to even break down tasks by AI and human in the project. And I want them to operate the AIs. And then I want to pay them on a project output base. Because what I notice a lot of my other business owner friends, we're all pissed off at our staff because we're like, okay, I gave you all this ChatGPT. I gave you all this stuff. And now you're still billing me the same amount of work for the same output with all this AI stuff. So either A, you're screwing me. B, you're not using these things and doing them manually. Mm. Or I don't even know what a third one is. So I'm trying to say, okay, I told them you just got to do more output. If you want the same amount of money, you can get the same amount of money, but you're going to have to do more output. And that's just the reality.
So I understand, and this is a topic that a lot of people talk about with the AI revolution, how jobs are going to be replaced, or you either become really good at using AI so you can increase your productivity and you can be more valuable for the organization that you work for, or you just don't work because now you have AI to help you build your business. That is way easier than before. So then you have these knowledges that you learn from work. And this is your topic that you're telling everyone who has a job to say, you should not keep having a job anymore down the road. You should really try to find a passion that you want, or you can ideally productize, even if it's a service, or you just find another product you want to build, and then you become your own business person.
Yeah. That's what I'm trying to do with my staff. Like, I could give you examples, but I'm trying to give them, like, a software to operate. And then I'm their customer. Okay. And then maybe other customers can buy that service.
Can we talk about opportunities? Because then you have a head start. You've been in this 20 years ago. You've seen the evolution, the trends. You can identify what product or services is going to be in demand. What are the opportunities right now if someone wants to jump into this game?
Like I said, I think we have an advantage. It's even if an individual or a small company, we have the advantage now over big companies. These big companies are downsizing. They got legacy software. They got legacy employees. We can disrupt huge companies. Like this poster, I made a whole events platform. I showed John, a lot of you didn't register with it, but whatever. I'm just getting it out there. But I made my own like meetup event with AI. And I think it's about hyper personalization. So I think the old way of one big SaaS doing everything is dead. I think the future is picking a SaaS you like, making a vertical. Maybe Stefan, he does all those meetups. He should make his own meetup website for a very specific vertical, or maybe Chiang Mai. Instead of going on these huge platforms, I think those huge platforms are going to get eaten alive. I think Meetup, LinkedIn, Facebook, you can make your own mini one. I'm making my own mini software now. It's vibe coding, but basically I think the opportunity is just like drop shipping a physical product. You can still do that, but I think you could take a big software and niche it down and make money with it, like having a very hyper-focused custom software to just almost copy Facebook and make it for a specific group of people.
I can imagine because of AI, because of the internet, obviously the knowledge is there to create a product is way easier than before. It's way less costly than before. But what about the sales and marketing side? Because I think this is something that I struggle to teach people or to tell or to explain to people the importance of understanding how to do good sales and marketing. That's not what AI can train or be trained.
Like a lot of my staff, I'm trying to tell them to do community management. Like community management, I think, is the most important role. And I think that's going to be really impossible or hard for AI to do. I think that's the role. And I think I don't think about sales and marketing. I think about community management. I think community management's more valuable than sales and marketing. Because essentially, it's almost the same thing, really, if you break it down. But it's better to be a community manager. I feel like I should call myself a community manager. I'm trying to identify a group of people that have a common interest, maybe common problems, common goals. I try to find the problems that they have, and I try to make a solution for that.
I'm building the community.
Yeah, so you have a good...
This is my community.
Exactly.
Now, the interesting thing is I don't necessarily see them as dollar signs or customers, even though they are paying me. But I guess in a business owner point of view, if you want to approach this aspect of community management, which is like a rebranding of sales acquisition, what is the difference in terms of approach?
Like you said, I think I'm similar to you. Like I have a problem with even money. I have a problem with selling. That's why I like e-commerce. I love to put something online. People like it. They give money. It goes to my bank. Like I don't need to like outbound sell. Like I like to create stuff people like. But I feel like community is similar. And I feel it's a softer sell, but you are selling because you're... What is good salespeople is just listening to a problem and making a solution. Maybe I am good at sales. I don't think I am, but half the time you just shut your mouth, let them talk, and then just say, you don't want to lie, but listen to what their problem is. Hopefully you have the solution. And, I can do that. That's usually a good sales, in my opinion, is listening to the problem and offering a solution. So as a community manager, community leader, you're listening to problems and you're giving a solution. Software, product, whatever. But
do you worry that, because I think about this again, and this is my last question before we might want to take a break.
I want the food, I'm hungry.
Yeah, and then maybe we can grab some food and then come back in for a discussion. Because every company or every platform wants to use the word community, and then they're creating a community. Is that going to be something that gets, what do you call it, watered down? It's just like a word that people use, but then at the end of the day, they're still trying to...
There's fake communities and there's real communities. Like I said, I'm somewhat in crypto. I go up and down in crypto. Like I think Bitcoin is always something you should get exposure to, not financial advice, but I feel pretty confident that you should maybe consider some Bitcoin. But the other stuff is like, we have a big community. Look at our Twitter followers. I did some fundraising Web3 recently, right? And it seems like all hot air. And they all say, even the community says their community, so that they can get some other sucker to buy their coin, to pump the price, to say we got a big community so that they can like exit liquidity. Yeah, there's lots of scams that everybody says they're a community member or a community leader because they're saying, like you said, that's like my customer or my exit liquidity or my buyer. But there's still real genuine communities. And usually it's like you. People know you care about your community and want to support you and the cause, but there's definitely still real communities. Hmm. There's tons of fake communities, but I think it's going to be more and more important with AI. People want to join a real community. I think it's going to be even more valuable. Not just someone, say I follow you on Twitter and I subscribe to your newsletter, like real community.
Got it. Okay. I want to take a pause here because we got some really yummy food. And Steve says, maybe we have another wave of people coming in.
Sorry, guys. I just realized in my system it's 7 p.m.
No problem. But why don't we grab some food, and then Mike's going to be here. I'm going to be here for a while.
Yeah, we can come back if it's needed or
and
you can
I
talk to us.
I definitely want you to introduce yourself to him so that you can ask him questions personally and we can start mingling around. And then if the feeling is right, we can sit down and we can have a closer group of the discussion about what kind of ideas he has.
Yeah, I mean, I'm really here to just...
Yeah, and if you have some ideas you want to pitch to Mike, he can tell you whether it's a good idea or a bad idea.
Yeah, it's not really an upsell, but I'm going to do like a call. My plan is my staff will join too.
Okay.
November 14th, I'm going to have a Zoom call.
Right.
Even if it's just my staff, but if some other people want to join, I'm really going to try to like maybe have a regular call, maybe a workshop, something like that. Maybe
we'll ask Mike to set up some office hours here so he can actually pick his brains. Yeah?
Yeah.
Okay. All right, let's take a break. Thank you.
Awesome. Thanks.
Yeah.
All right. Thanks, Mike, for that pre-cross-border summit event you put together. There were a couple other pre-events we did this year leading up to the cross-border summit, right?
Yes, always experimenting. We put together a few smaller free meetups for the community leading up to the main event this year with local leaders like John Ho and the Alt Co-Living community. It was a fun experiment and hope to expand that next year with more events leading up to the main event.
Now, I am on the edge of my seat. Tell us about what you and your son chatted about. You hinted towards earlier in the episode.
Yes, well, my son, he's now 11 years old, born around the same time this podcast started, and he is starting to get regular homework. I'm noticing he's starting to do his homework at the end of the night, around 9 p.m. or so. So I am asking him why he plays video games and other things before he does his homework, and he has various reasons. So I don't want to be the father who pushes and forces, but I suggest to him that he should consider doing his homework at the beginning to get it over with, or even at least focus on his homework when he is doing it, as I am catching him checking electronics, playing with a toy or gadget, etc. While he is working, I'm showing him various timers and tools to push him to focus on just his homework in a focus session in order to get it done faster and with less pain and agony.
Sounds cool, and you're not forcing it on him.
No, I mean, I wish he would listen about the timer, but I still see him doing it the inefficient way. I just remind him if he tried my way, it would be much more effective, faster, and less painful. Hopefully he'll listen soon.
Yes, let's hope. Cool, you are not pushing too hard.
And this is life. I believe if you force something on someone, they won't do it. And we need to encourage and support the person as they learn and grow. Same with team, partners, and anyone, in my opinion. Just like this main content of the show, no one else is going to push you to start and grow your own business. It is up to you to have the will to make it be.
Thanks for tuning in to Global from Asia. Subscribe for more actionable advice on cross-border e-commerce and entrepreneurship. See you next time.
To get more info about running an international business, please visit our website at www.globalfromasia.com. That's www.globalfromasia.com. Also, be sure to subscribe to our iTunes feed. Thanks for tuning in.